Such was his resolve that he paid no heed to the voice of reason that bade him to take more care. Nothing could stop him from racing toward the settlement, spurred on by the ever-growing column of dark smoke. That afternoon, sweat-drenched, he reached the top of the hill and looked down on the settlement. Goodwater was ablaze. Breaches several paces across had opened in the palisades, and there were two large gaps where the wooden defences had been raised to the ground. Mutilated limbs and bodies littered the perimeter. He soon spotted the remains of the mercenaries, heads impaled on their spears. Their unseeing eyes stared down from the watchtower as the fire raged unchecked through the settlement, reducing the houses to charred shells. There were no cries for help, no shouted orders to fetch water or quench the blaze. All Tungdil could hear was the crackling of flames, the roar of burning wood, and the crash of collapsing roofs and walls. There was no sign of life. Clutching his axe, Tungdil marched towards the burned-out settlement.
"Maybe I'll find a few survivors trapped among the ruins."
He gripped his weapon a little tighter as he passed through the gates and turned onto the high street, limping as he walked. The warm wind smelled of scorched flesh, and flames were shooting out of the houses where panes of glass had shattered in the heat. The whole settlement was on fire. Human corpses were strewn across the streets and pavements, bodies piled up like dead vermin. Some of the women were naked, the flesh of their breasts and buttocks gouged with bite marks and scratches. There was no mistaking their particular fate. Shuddering, Tungdil stepped over the slaughtered villagers and listened intently for the slightest sign that anyone was still alive. It was deathly quiet. All the while, the heat was intensifying. The surviving walls acted like a furnace, trapping the fire and raising the temperature dangerously. The dwarf had no choice but to leave the dying settlement. Back on the hilltop, Tungdil sat down and made himself watch Goodwater's final moments.
"It's my fault."
He buried his bearded chin in his hands and wept in despair. Long moments passed before the tears of anger and helplessness began to slow. Now he could see why his kinsfolk stood guard at Gerdlegard's passes. Humans were powerless to defend themselves against the brutal beasts. Tungdil looked down through his tears at the burned-out settlement. Nowhere should ever be made to look like that. He dried his salt-streaked cheeks and wiped his hands on his cloak. His calf was throbbing so painfully that he decided to delay his departure until the following orbit. Curling up on the hillside, he pulled his cloak over him and watched the flames flicker as evening drew in. The fire raged long into the night until there was nothing left to burn. Red glimmers illuminated the ashes, and Tungdil was reminded of the Shadow Mare's menacing eyes.
"So much evil in such a short space of time," he thought sadly.
Tomorrow he would press on with his errand and deliver the pouch. Then it would be time for him to persuade Lotionen to take action before the orcs and Elfar grew any more powerful. When Tungdil woke the next morning, he was forced to concede that the sacking of Goodwater was not, as he had hoped, just a dream. Grey clouds obscured the sun, and the smell of rain hung in the air. There was nothing left of the settlement besides smoking embers, rubble, and burned-out houses, whose scorched girders rose starkly into the sky like blackened skeletons. The fields and orchards were covered with a white mist that advanced over the remains of Goodwater, hiding it from view. The land was mourning the villagers, laying a shroud over the settlement that only an orbit earlier had bustled with life. The sight was too much for Tungdil to bear, so he gathered his packs and set off. As he hobbled on his way, he tried to eat a little something from his provisions, but the bread he had bought in Goodwater stuck in his throat. There was a cloying taste of death and guilt. He stowed the loaf away. The gashes in his calf were angry and painful. If he left the wound untreated, he ran the risk of infection or even gangrene, which could cost him his leg, or worse still, his life. That aside, the journey passed without incident, and he crossed back into Gauragar and camped that evening beneath the now familiar oak. Its leafy canopy sheltered him from the downpour that started that night, only easing late the next morning. By the fifth orbit, the skin surrounding the crusty wound felt hot to the touch, and thick yellow pus oozed from the scab. Gritting his teeth, Tungdil walked on. There was no use waiting for help by the wayside. Instead, he kept going, trailing his injured leg through the fine drizzle that was rapidly transforming the trail into a mud bath. At last he reached a small hamlet, numbering 6 farmhouses. His forehead was burning. A fair-haired woman in simple peasant dress, a milk pail in either hand, spotted the staggering figure. She stopped in her tracks. Tungdil could barely make out her features. She was just a faint shadow.
"Frakis be with you," he murmured, then toppled over, landing face first in the mud, his arms too weak to break his fall.
"Opetya!"
the woman called urgently, setting down her pails.
"Come quickly!"
There was the sound of hurrying footsteps, then Tungdil was rolled onto his back.
"He's feverish,"
said a blurry, misshapen figure, his voice echoing oddly in the dwarf's ears. Someone was examining his leg.
"He doesn't look good. It's gangrenous. We have to move him to the barn."
Tungdil felt himself hovering in mid-air.
"He'll need a herbal infusion."
"He looks funny," said a childish voice. "What is he?"
"He's a groundling," the woman answered.
"You told me they live in the ground. What's he doing up here?"
"Not now, Jemta. Take your brothers and sisters inside," the man said impatiently.
The air was warm and smelled of hay. Tungdil could hear mooing. The rain seemed to stop and the light dimmed.
"Good water," he said weakly. "Good water has fallen to the orcs."
"What did he say?"
The woman sounded worried.
"Pay no attention," the man said dismissively. "He's feverish, that's all. Look, he must have been caught in a wolf trap. Either that or the orc had metal jaws."
They both chuckled. The dwarf clutched at the man's arm.
"You're right. I'm feverish,"
he said, making a last attempt to warn them.
"But the orcs are coming. They're heading in 3 directions, west, south, and east. 3 tribes, at least 300 troopers."
Footsteps approached rapidly.
"Here's the infusion," said the girl.
"So that's what a groundling looks like."
"Eva, you go inside too," the man ordered.
There was a brief pause. Then Tungdil felt as though his leg were being dunked in boiling oil. Even as he screamed, the world went dark around him.
"But he doesn't even have a proper beard."
Tungdil detected a note of disappointment in the girl's voice.
"Grandpa said they always have long beards, but this one's shorter than father's. It's like scratchy wool. Do you think he's got gold and diamonds?"
The speaker took a step closer.
"Remember what Grandma told us? Groundlings are richer than anyone." "Come back here," hissed the girl. "You can't just search his pockets. It's rude."
Tungdil's eyes flicked open. Squealing, the children jumped back in a flurry of straw. He sat up and looked around. 9 children were gathered around him, staring with a mixture of curiosity and fear. Their ages ranged from 4 to 14 cycles, and they were clad in plain garments. Nothing they wore could have cost more than a single bronze coin. His leg had been dressed and was throbbing a bit, but the pain was gone and his temperature was back to normal. They had taken good care of him.
"Frakis be with you," he greeted them.
"Could you tell me where I am and who was kind enough to tend to me?"
"He speaks just like us,"
said a red-headed boy with sticking-out ears. The eldest girl, her brown hair in 2 plaits, grinned.
"Of course he talks like us. Why wouldn't he?"
She nodded at him.
"I'm Eva. Mother found you 5 orbits ago. You fell over in the mud, but father and the others picked you up and looked after you."
She sent a fair-haired girl, Jemta, to fetch the grown-ups.
"Are you better now? Do you want something to eat?"
5 orbits ago?
To Tungdil it seemed more like a short doze. His stomach rumbled loudly.
I suppose some food would be in order, and something to drink as well.
He smiled. The children reminded him of Frala, Sunya, and baby Ikana.
"Haven't you ever seen a dwarf before?"
The harmless inquiry unleashed a deluge of questions.
Which folk do you belong to? Are you rich? Where are your diamonds? How many orcs have you slain? Are all groundlings small like you? Is it true you can smash rocks with your bare hands? Why isn't your beard very long? How many names have you got?
Stop, stop, Tungdil pleaded, laughing. I can't answer everyone at once.
You can take it in turns, but first I have to tell your parents something. He wanted to save the news of the orcs for the grown-ups. There was no need to scare the children. A fair-haired woman, whom he vaguely remembered from his last lucid moment 5 orbits ago, came in with a basket of victuals on her arm. The smell was enough to make his mouth water.
I'm Remsa, she said. And I'm Tungdil. You saved my life, and for that I'm eternally grateful.
He lowered his voice. But I'm going to have to ask you to send the children away.
Why?
Jemta protested cheekily. He grinned at her.
Because certain things aren't meant for young ears.
They left.
You're not still on about good water, are you?
Said the woman.
You had all kinds of nightmares while you were ill.
They weren't nightmares, Remsa. It's the truth. The orcs, they... Never mind about that. You have to get out of here. They're coming. They're heading south, east, and west. 3 whole tribes of orcs, numbering 100 troopers each. You'll be killed. They'll slaughter your animals and set light to your farms. You have to go.
Remsa placed a hand on his brow. The temperature's gone, she said thoughtfully. You don't seem feverish.
She unpacked some bread, milk, cheese, and cured meat, and laid them on the blanket to protect them from the straw.
So it's true, is it?
I'll tell Optia, and we'll send a messenger to Steepleton. The Privy Council will know what to do.
There's no time for that. They're on their way already,
he said with as much urgency as the mouthful of sausage allowed. Hunger had got the better of him, and he was tucking in ravenously.
You've been sick for 5 orbits, don't forget. They'd be here by now if they wanted to attack. We'll send out a scout just in case.
Is there any way of getting a message through from Steepleton?
A rider or even a carrier pigeon would reach the major cities of Girdlegard faster than anyone else. Those services were by no means cheap, but at least they could be relied on to spread the news quickly.
A message?
I'll send someone who can note it down for you.
Oh, it's no trouble.
Tungdil interrupted politely.
I can write.
He could hardly blame her for assuming he was illiterate. Most country people were unschooled.
I just need some parchment and ink, and someone to take the letter as far as Steepleton. It's for Lot Ionan in Ionundar.
She nodded and checked the dressing on his calf.
You were lucky not to lose your leg, you know. It's a good thing we found you when we did. Another orbit, and you'd be wearing a wooden peg. That trap must have been a rusty old thing. Make sure you eat and get some rest.
She gave strict instructions to the children to leave him in peace, but they soon returned, giggling and bearing parchment and a quill. From then on, it was impossible to get rid of them. Knowing nothing of dwarves save for stories and legends, they were determined to satisfy their curiosity while they had the chance. They stared at him raptly, following every loop and flourish of the quill as he composed his message to the Magus. The letter contained a full account of all that had happened in Goodwater. The pact between the orcs and Alpha, the designs of Nodon, who was said to be the ruler of the perished land, and other salient facts.
I hope it gets there in time, he worried silently.
He made a second copy in case the first went missing en route, then lay back in exhaustion on his soft bed of straw. As soon as the children saw that the letter was complete, they pestered him with yet more questions. This time Tungdil answered with one of his own.
Who can tell me about the Black Saddle?
I can,
Jemta volunteered proudly.
It's almost 300 miles from here. Father says it's near the highway. He knows all about Girdlegard from when he used to be a trader.
She paused for a second.
I know. I'll go and get him for you. He'll describe it better than me.
Jumping to her feet, she dashed out like a whirlwind and returned a few moments later with Optia, a stocky, grey-haired man. To Tungdil's delight, he came bearing a tankard of beer.
The Black Saddle, you say? He asked. An unnatural sort of place.
There's a road, all right, but it doesn't lead straight to the mountain. You'll have to hack your way through the forest for the final mile or two. He picked up Tungdil's map and traced a rough route. You can't miss it. A flat black mountain poking above the trees.
Flat, said the dwarf in surprise, taking a grateful sip of his beer.
The children drew closer, listening intently. Optian nodded. Think of it as a giant tablet of soap that slipped from Palandiel's hands. It's 400 paces high, 300 paces wide, and it runs for a full mile, plus another 200 or so paces.
To show the dwarf exactly what he meant, he sliced a hunk of cheese and cut long vertical gouges into its sides.
That's from the wind and rain, he explained to the children.
Ah, a table mountain. They call them that because the summit is flat like a tabletop. I read about them in my Magus's library.
He tried to imagine how the black saddle would look in real life. Opatia's description had vaguely reminded him of a legend, but he couldn't for the life of him remember how it went. Oh well, the 300-mile march would give him ample opportunity to search his memory.
What do you want with the black saddle?
I'm looking for a wizard, a former apprentice of my Magus. He moved there some time ago, and now Lot Ionan is concerned for his well-being. He won't rest until I've seen him for myself.
Opatia contemplated Tungdil's injured leg.
Leave it a few more orbits before you set off. We'll give you some healing herbs, so you can keep treating it while you're on the move.
He picked up the letters to Lot Ionan and rose to his feet.
Thank you, Tungdil said warmly. I'm most grateful to you.
Don't mention it, replied the former merchant with a laugh.
I've never seen the little rascals so quiet.
He left his guest with the children, who resumed their persistent questioning as soon as he was gone. They could hardly believe their ears when Tungdil told them he was 63 cycles old.
Shouldn't your beard be much longer? Jemta asked suspiciously. I asked Grandpa, and he said groundlings grow their beards to the floor.
I'm a dwarf, not a groundling.
And besides, I grew my beard for 30 cycles before I had to shave it off. It kept getting scorched by the sparks in the forge, and then some scoundrel dyed it blue.
The boy with the protruding ears reached out to touch it.
It's much wirier and curlier than father's, he pronounced.
You should try combing it. Imagine how long it takes to braid.
The dwarf grinned and showed them one of his plaits.
It's willful and unruly, just like us. We dwarves hold competitions to see who can grow the longest, bushiest beards, and we decorate our braids with beads and metal trinkets. Most of my kinsfolk look like me. Very few of us have mustaches, sideboards, or chin straps, and fewer still have no beard at all.
He could tell them all about it thanks to Lot Ionan's books.
Giggling, the children fashioned their own beards by plaiting stalks of hay and sticking them to their chins with globules of sap scraped from the wooden beams.
Do all groundlings, do all dwarves have beards?
Absolutely. If you see a clean-shaven dwarf, you can be sure that it's a punishment for something. An exiled dwarf won't be allowed home until his beard has reached the length of his axe haft. And since our beards grow so slowly, the banishment lasts for cycles.
Book learning, he thought sadly. Book learning passed on to me by humans. He sighed.
Jemta seized her chance and snatched the straw from the chin of the jug-eared boy.
There, you're banished. Be off with you.
In no time, the battle of the beard was raging, with all the youngsters intent on banishing one another from the barn. In the end, Remsa reappeared and put an end to the fun. Amid loud protests, the children were made to say their goodnights and go to bed. The woman smiled at him warmly.
They've taken to you, she said. They're not this friendly with everyone, you know.
Good night to you, Tungdil. We'll ask Palandiel to mend your leg.
They actually like me.
It came as a welcome surprise. Frala and her daughters would surely feel at home here.
So much has happened already, they won't believe the half of it.
He stroked the scarf that Frala had given him, then lay back and put his arms behind his head. If only he could have answered the children's questions about dwarven hordes and dwarven customs with proper authority, instead of gleaning his knowledge from books. It's about time I got to know my own people, he thought.
Chapter 4 Kingdom of Gauragar, Gerdlegard, Late Spring, 6234th Solar Cycle. Tungdil soon had the chance to repay his hosts for their kindness in nursing him back to health. Two orbits later, when his leg was almost mended, he set to work in the hamlet's little forge, tackling all the jobs that the regular smith, the only one in the vicinity, was unable to do on account of a broken arm. From the man's point of view, the dwarf's assistance, unpaid of course, was a godsend. While the children worked the bellows and squabbled over taking turns, Tungdil placed the iron in the furnace and waited until it glowed red with heat. The youngsters watched as he hammered the metal amid showers of sparks. With every thud of the hammer, there were squeals of delight. The smith nodded at Tungdil admiringly.
"It's not often you see such swift work," he complimented him. "And good quality, too. Maybe it's true that metalwork was invented by groundlings."
"We're dwarves, not groundlings."
"Sorry," said the man with an apologetic smile. "I meant dwarves."
Tungdil grinned.
"Well, no matter how fast I work, there's enough to keep me busy for a good long while. How about I stay another orbit? I can always leave for the Black Saddle after that."
They were interrupted by Jemta.
"Show me how to make nails," she demanded.
"You want to be a smith, do you?"
Tungdil patted the blonde child on the head, then set about teaching her how to make a nail. While she ran off proudly to show her handiwork to her parents, he turned his attention to forging a new windlass for the well. It was mid-afternoon when he left his perch to lie down in a tub of cool water. His clothes reeked of perspiration, so he climbed in fully dressed.
"I'm surprised my skin doesn't hiss like hot iron," he thought.
The cold water took his breath away, but then he sank luxuriously below the surface and came up, snorting and gasping for air. He was just wiping the water from his eyes when a shadow fell over the tub. There was a clunking of metal and the smell of oil.
"Plate armor," thought Tungdil, blinking nervously.
A solid man of around 30 cycles was leaning against the outside wall of the forge, arms folded in front of his armored chest. Despite the various weapons about his person, he had no uniform or insignia to identify him as a soldier.
"Were you looking for me, sir?"
asked Tungdil, stepping out of the tub. Water streamed from his clothes, drenching the sandy floor.
"Are you the smith?"
"I'm standing in for him at the moment. Is there something you'd like repaired?"
The dwarf did his best to be polite, even though he had taken an instant dislike to the man. The stranger's grey eyes bored into him, as if to read his innermost thoughts.
"Two of our horses need shoeing. Are you up to it?"
That was enough to turn Tungdil against him forever.
"I should hope so. What else would I be doing in a forge? I may as well ask you if you know how to ride."
The dwarf left the bath, trying to look as dignified as possible, while leaving a trail of water behind him and making squelching noises as if he were tramping through a bog. His hair hung limply down his back. Waiting outside on the narrow, rutted road were six horses and four men in what looked like full battle dress. One of the horses was laden with kitchen utensils, leather packs, and two rolled-up nets. The men were conversing in low tones, but fell silent when Tungdil approached. They looked at him oddly, but made no remark. The dwarf instructed one of the men to work the bellows. Air hissed into the furnace, fanning the glowing coals until flames licked around them, quivering and flickering above the burning fuel. Tungdil was enveloped in heat, his hair and clothes drying in no time. He was in his element.
"Are you mercenaries?"
he asked the fellow on the bellows. Unhurriedly, he chose a hammer and some nails, while another man led in the lame horse. Tungdil held the shoe against the hoof. The fit was right.
"You could say that," came the curt reply. "We hunt orcs and criminals with a price on their head."
Tungdil placed the shoe among the burning embers and waited.
"I suppose business is good at the moment," he probed. "What of the orcs who raised Goodwater?"
"Gauragar is a big place.
and Brurun soldiers can't be everywhere at once. We've enough to keep us busy, the leader of the company said brusquely. The conversation was over. Working in silence, Tungdil hammered the horseshoe into shape and fitted it to the hoof. A cloud of yellowish smoke filled the forge. When the job was done, he demanded twice his usual price. The mercenaries paid without objecting and rode away. Tungdil watched them go and dismissed them from his mind. The next orbit flew by, and already it was time for him to leave. The children in particular were disappointed. They had grown fond of the stocky little fellow who showered them with metal trinkets. Tungdil thanked his hosts profusely. Without your healing powers, a festering wound like that could have killed me. He dug out the extra money that he had taken from the mercenaries and handed it to Apatia.
We can't accept this, the villager objected. That's your business, but I won't be taking it back. It's not often a dwarf agrees to part with money.
He was so insistent that the coins eventually found their way into Apatia's purse.
Remsa gave him a pouch of herbs.
Lay them on your wounds before you go to sleep. Soon your leg will be as good as new.
They all shook hands, and he went on his way. The children followed him until the sky grew darker and rain clouds gathered overhead.
Will you come and see us on your way home? Jemta asked mournfully.
Of course, little one. It's an honor to have made your acquaintance. Keep practicing, and you'll make a fine smith.
He offered her his hand, but she darted forward and hugged him instead.
Now we're friends,
she said, waving and running back toward the hamlet. As she rounded the corner, she shouted,
Don't forget to come back!
Tungdil was so surprised that he stood there for a moment, hand outstretched, in the middle of the road.
Well, well, who would have thought I could win over a girl child so easily?
He marched off in good spirits, thinking fondly of the people left behind. The spring weather had taken a turn for the worse. Dark clouds covered every inch of sky, and rain had settled for the duration. After a while, even his boots were soaked, his feet cold and swollen inside the sopping leather. In spite of the unpleasant conditions, Tungdil was making good progress, but the thought of the orcs and the incursion of the perished land, as foretold by the Elfar, preyed on his mind. He remembered what Lotionen had told him about the invasion of the northern pestilence. The perished land extended 650 miles across Girdlegard, swallowing the whole of the former Fifthling kingdom, and much of the northern border besides, and reaching another 400 miles southward, where it tapered to approximately half that breadth. Tungdil reached the shelter of a rocky overhang, and examined his map. In his mind's eye, he pictured the insidious evil as a wedge forcing itself into Girdlegard, its tip grinding against the Magi's magic barrier and leveling off, unable to advance any farther. Now it seemed that the perished land's ruler, the mysterious Nodon, was intent on extending his dominion, and he was undoubtedly making progress, in spite of the Magi's girdle. In the east, the Alfar kingdom of Jon Balsur was eating its way into Gaurigar like a festering sore, covering an area 200 miles long by 70 miles wide. And while the stone gateway remained open, there was nothing to stop further armies of foul beasts from entering Girdlegard from the north.
The Magi will have their work cut out now that Taborobor has allied itself with the Northern Blight.
The wizards were powerful, but they could only be in one place at a time.
At least they'll be forewarned.
According to his calculations, the message would have reached Lotionen by now. All around him, the varied landscape of Gaurigar was doing its best to recompense him for the dreadful events at the start of his trip. Even the rain could not dull the vibrant springtime colors, although Tungdil was too focused on his journey to pay much attention to the lush splendor of the knolls, woods, and meadows. At length, he came to an abandoned temple, a small edifice dedicated to Palandiel. Light streamed through manifold windows, illuminating carvings that symbolized fertility and long life. Palandiel commanded the loyalty of most humans, but she was too soft and indecisive for Tungdil's taste. He was a follower of Vrakas, to whom temples had been constructed in some of the larger cities, or so he had read in Lotionen's books. Some humans preferred Elria,
the water deity, while others prayed to the wind god Samusin, who regarded men, elves, dwarves, and beasts as creatures of equal standing, and strove for an equilibrium between evil and good. Teon, dark lord and creator of foul beasts, was more feared than admired in Gerdlegard.
"I don't know anyone who would worship him," Tungdil thought in relief.
Lotionen's household, Frale included, prayed to Palandiel. Tungdil had erected his own special altar and dedicated it to the god of the dwarves, who had hewn the five founding fathers from unyielding granite and brought them to life. From time to time he smelted gold in his furnace as an offering. For all he knew, he was the only dwarf in Gerdlegard to follow such a custom, but he wanted to give Vrakas a share of the best. His brown eyes surveyed the ivy-covered walls of the derelict temple.
"Perhaps men will have greater cause to pray to Palandiel in the future," he mused.
Later he stood aside as a unit of well-armored cavalrymen rode by. Their mail, embellished with the crest of King Bruron, clunked noisily, and mud sprayed from the horse's hooves, spattering his cloak. He counted 200 riders in all.
"Will that be enough to defeat a war band of orcs?"
From then on, Tungdil regularly encountered patrol groups. By the look of things, news of the marauding hordes in Eidoslain had travelled fast. Rather than relying on Tilagorn to put a stop to the destruction, King Bruron of Gaurogar was taking steps of his own to hunt down the orcs. It pleased Tungdil to see that the humans had heeded his warning. History would hardly remember the actions of Tungdil Bolifar, a dwarf without clan or folk, who had alerted Gaurogar to the danger by calling on a peasant family to send word to the authorities that good water had been destroyed. What mattered was that he knew about it, and it filled him with pride. Most nights Tungdil slept beneath the stars, although occasionally he made his bed in a barn, and once he allowed himself the luxury of a room at an inn. It seemed prudent to save the dwindling contents of his purse. After 9 orbits, his leg was fully mended. The rigors of the journey had made a lasting impression on his girth, and his belt sat 2 holes tighter than usual. Walking was good for his stamina, and he no longer panted when he journeyed uphill. Even his feet had become accustomed to the daily toil. At night he sometimes dreamed of Goodwater, the horrors he had seen there still present in his mind. It took another few orbits of marching before the Black Saddle finally loomed into view. The mountain looked almost exactly like the model that Opatia had irreverently fashioned from cheese, except its sides were pitch black. Sunlight glistened on the deep gullies running vertically down the mountain's sheer flanks. The forbidding rock jutted out of the landscape like an abandoned boulder, and was surrounded by a murky forest of conifers. The trees looked small and fragile by comparison, although the smallest among them was 50 paces high.
"In times gone by, it must have been a proper mountain, with a summit towering miles above the ground. Perhaps the gods snapped it off as a punishment, and left the base like a tree stump in the soil."
There was something vaguely sinister about the mountain. Tungdil couldn't define it exactly, but he knew he would never have gone there by choice. He could only assume that Gurin prized his solitude more than most. Brushing aside these misgivings, Tungdil hefted his bags and continued along the gravel road that wound past the forest, half a mile to the east. He kept looking for a path or a gap in the trees, but at sundown he was back where he had started, and none the wiser for it all.
"What a strange forest. Tomorrow I'll have to cut my way through the undergrowth if the trees won't let me pass."
He could feel the tiredness in his limbs, so he set up camp by the roadside and lit a fire, keeping a watchful eye on the forest for predators. Soon afterward he was joined by 2 peddlers, who seemed thoroughly relieved not to be spending the night on their own. They stopped their covered wagons by his fire and unhitched their mules. Their consignment of pots and pans rattled and jangled louder than a battalion of armed men.
"Is there room at the fire?"
asked the first, introducing himself and his companion. Hill and Carolus were everything Tundil expected of the human male. Tall and unshaven, with long hair, plain apparel, and needlessly loud voices. They laughed, joked, and passed the bottle of brandy back and forth, but their jollity seemed forced.
"I don't mean to be nosy," said Tungdil.
but you seem a little on edge. Hill stopped laughing abruptly.
You're observant, groundling.
Dwarf. I'm a dwarf.
A dwarf, I see. I didn't know there was a difference.
There isn't, but the proper term is dwarf, just as you prefer to be called humans and not grasslings or beanpoles. Hill grinned.
My mistake.
We're afraid of the mountain and the creatures in the woods, said Carolus. That's the truth of the matter. We wouldn't normally stop here, but our old nags are beat.
He broke 4 eggs into a frying pan and invited Hill and the dwarf to share in his meal. So what's wrong with the mountain? Asked Tungdil, dipping a crust into the egg yolk. Carolus looked at him incredulously.
I thought every groundling, dwarf, knew about the black saddle. Very well, I shall tell you the story of the mount that lost its peak.
Hill settled down by the fire, and his companion began his tale.
Many cycles ago, there was a mountain called Cloud Piercer, whose summit towered high into the sky. Taller and prouder than any other peak in Gerblagard, it was tipped with snow throughout the seasons, and its loftiest pitches were made of pure gold. Everyone could see the mountain's riches, but no one could reach them. The golden crown rested on impossibly sheer and unyielding slopes, and the glare from the snow and the precious metal blinded any who looked at the summit for too long. But the people's desire for the gold was overwhelming, and they summoned the dwarves to their aid. A delegation came to Gaurigar to examine the golden mountain and set about it with pickaxes, chisels, and spades. Owing to the superior quality of their tools, they succeeded in burrowing their way into the mountain and digging a tunnel to the top. They hollowed out the mountain and carried away its treasures without being dazzled by the gold. Of course, the people of Gaurigar were furious and demanded to be given a portion of the trove. While the men and dwarves were quarreling, the mountain came to life, quaking with fury and bent on shaking the plunderers from its core. By then, of course, its flesh was riddled with shafts and tunnels, and the tip of the mountain fell in on itself, crushing the looters beneath its weight. And now you know the story of how Cloudpiercer lost its summit and its glory. Since then, the denuded mountain has simmered with murderous hatred, its treacherous slopes darkening with malice as it plots its revenge against the races of men and dwarves.
The fire crackled loudly. Carolus threw on another log to keep the flames going and drive out the darkness.
I knew there was something sinister about it, thought Tungdil.
He wondered what it said about Gareen's character that he had chosen to make his home there. It seemed a strange place to live.
Folk say that wayfarers who venture into the woods are set upon by monsters, the peddler added. The mountain lures the creatures to it with the promise of easy prey. Sometimes hunger drives them out of the forest and into the towns. They eat anything, man or beast.
He shuddered. Well, it's good to have company, Tungdil said sincerely, steeling himself for the next morning's march among the trees. At least he had his axe for protection.
Wait till you hear my story.
He started to tell of his recent experiences, of his night in Goodwater and the meeting between the Alfar and the Orcs, but his account tailed off when he came to describing the destruction of the settlement. The memories were still too fresh. Retreating into silence, he tried to get some sleep, but the trees had set themselves against him, creaking and groaning as soon as he closed his eyes. The forest seemed to take pleasure in keeping him awake. Hill and Carolus were oblivious to the noise. Belatedly, it dawned on Tungdil why the men had partaken so freely of the brandy. Their senses had been dulled so completely that nothing could rouse them from their sleep. The task of watching over the camp and their lives was left to the unfortunate Tungdil. With the coming of dawn, the rustling in the forest finally subsided, and the peddlers packed their wagons, wished the dwarf a safe journey, and rode away, refreshed and alert. Tungdil hadn't slept a wink. He gazed glumly at the forest, peering into the murk. Fretting wasn't going to get him anywhere, and he had to press on. Gareen lived in the Black Saddle, probably in the ruins of the dwarven tunnels, if Carolus's story was to be believed.
Monsters or no monsters, I'm coming through.
He gripped his axe with both hands and stepped among the trees,
At once, his whole being was assailed by malice and spite. There was no mistaking the mountain's displeasure at his approach. Tungdil walked on regardless, intent on delivering the artifacts to Gareen so he could return to the comfort of Lothaeonan's vaults. The sooner he accomplished his errand, the sooner he would be home. Who knows, maybe the secondlings have replied to the letter already, he thought brightly. At length his obstinacy and determination paid off, and he reached the foot of the mountain, with the forest behind him, and not a monster in sight. Maybe the beasts attacked only after nightfall. In any event, he had made it unscathed. The sheer sides of the Black Saddle towered above him, steep, dark, and unmistakably hostile. For a moment he was tempted to run away. Even as he stood there, a volley of rocks sped toward him, and he dove for cover just in time, the final boulder missing him by the span of a hand. Each one of the rocks had been big enough to kill him, but he refused to be daunted. He had to find Gareen. Tungdil circled the base of the mountain without discovering any indication of a dwelling or path. He took to calling the wizard's name, in the hope that he would hear him, but was met with no response. Muttering under his breath, he set out a second time around the mountain. This time, as he scanned the dark, fissured walls, he spotted a narrow flight of stairs hewn skillfully into the rock. The breadth of the steps suited him exactly, but a big-booted man would have struggled to keep his footing on the narrow stone slabs. 100 paces, 200 paces, 300 paces. Tungdil ascended the mountain, crawling on all fours and clinging to the sculpted steps. There was nothing else to hold on to. From time to time, the mountain cast stones at him, or loosed an avalanche of scree. Pebbles grazed his hands and face, and a rock glanced off his forehead, tearing a gash in his skin. Feeling suddenly dizzy, Tungdil pressed himself against the flank of the mountain, letting go only when the world stopped spinning. He wiped the blood from his eyes, gritted his teeth, and climbed on.
"You can't shake me off that easily. Fracas created the dwarves from rock so we would rule the mountains. I'll conquer you yet," he bellowed.
He could tell from the angle of his shadow that the sun had passed its zenith and was sinking in the sky. A cold wind whistled around him, tugging at his bags. With every step, his situation was becoming more perilous, and he hardly dared consider the descent. But at last he mustered the courage to glance down at the fair land of Gauragar, 400 paces below. He had never seen such an incredible display of color and light. The sun and clouds were playing on the landscape, casting fleeting shadows over the meadows, fields, and forests. If he strained his eyes, he could make out settlements in the distance, the individual buildings resembling tiny blocks of stone. Rivers wound their way through the countryside like shimmering veins, and the air smelled of spring. The view was so spectacular that it almost stopped his breath. It gave him a sense of power and majesty, as if he himself were a mountain. He could see now why the dwarves had chosen to make their homes in Gerdlegard's ranges. He continued his ascent, climbing with new vigor and courage, until at last he reached a recess in the flank of the mountain, some 500 paces above the ground. It seemed as good a place as any to spend the night. The alcove was large enough to shelter him from the fierce winds and protect him from further attempts on the part of the Black Saddle to pelt him with rocks. He crawled inside cautiously.
"Tomorrow will take care of itself."
The sinking sun bathed the gloomy walls of his simple shelter in reddish light, playing on the textured rock. Tungdil stared at the fissured surface. There was something about the markings that reminded him of runes. He blinked.
"Surely not."
He ran his hand over the rock.
"There's definitely something there."
Time and nature had worn away at the rock, but his searching fingertips found the shallow furrows of chiseled runes. Tungdil had a sudden thought. Opening his tinderbox, he kindled a flame and scorched the haft of his axe. Taking the map from his pack, he laid it face down against the wall and ran the charred wood across the parchment. At first, the improvised charcoal wouldn't stick to the paper, but at length he succeeded in shading over the runes. The symbols appeared on the parchment, pale remnants of an ancient script.
Long moments passed while Tungdil studied the markings, struggling to make sense of the strange, cumbersome formulations. At last, when he had translated the runes into modern dwarfish, he was able to divine the meaning of the lines.
Built with blood, it was drenched in blood. Erected against the Fourthlings, it fell against the Fourthlings. Cursed by the Fourthlings, then abandoned by all five. Roused by the Thirdlings, against the will of the Thirdlings. Drenched again, in blood. The blood of all their line.
The mason had carved the verse in the shape of a tree, symbolizing renewal and the eternal cycle of life. There was no way of gauging the age of the inscription, especially since the treatise on dwarven language in Lotionen's library made no mention of such things. But Tungdil couldn't escape the impression that the runes were terribly old, a message from a long-forgotten era, at least 1,000 cycles past. He breathed life into the words, reciting them aloud and listening raptly to the strange yet familiar syllables, so different from human speech. The language moved him, stirred him, churning his emotions. He wasn't the only one roused by the sound. The ancient runes rolled through the folds and wrinkles of the mountain and woke the Black Saddle too. Something shifted in its memory, and its hatred of the dwarves returned with a vengeance, this time directed at Tungdil. The Black Saddle quaked.
"I'm not going anywhere!"
He pressed his back against the rock, determined not to be shaken out of the alcove by the shuddering mountain. Just then, the wall behind him stirred as well. Grinding and groaning, it slid back to reveal a tunnel. The shaking stopped abruptly. Tungdil decided it meant one of two things. Either the Black Saddle was trying to lure him inside and hold him prisoner in its flesh, or Gareen was welcoming him to his den. With that, the matter was settled. He collected his things, shouldered the bag of artifacts, and strode determinedly into the tunnel. After barely 3 paces, he felt an almighty shudder, and the doorway closed on Girdlegard's night sky. The stars of Girdlegard twinkled their farewell, and the dwarf was trapped inside. Enchanted Realm of Lios Nudin, Girdlegard, Late Spring, 6234th Solar Cycle. The lofty buildings of the majestic palace shone luminous white against the clear blue sky. Sable turrets rose among the domed roofs, sparkling in the sunshine. Like beacons, their shimmering brightness and imposing height lit the way to Lios Nudin from a distance of 50 miles. A traveler would have to be blind to miss Perista. Lotionen feasted his eyes on the view. The circumstances surrounding the council's meeting were worrying, but he was looking forward to seeing the others all the same. With a tug on the reins, he curbed his mount and rode through the city at a more sedate pace. Snorting, Furo made it known that he would rather gallop and feel the wind in his mane. Tradition dictated that the meetings of the council took place in Perista's opulent palace, a custom upheld by Girdlegard's Magi for 2 millennia. The reason for the venue was twofold. Firstly, the practical consideration of a central location, and secondly, and more crucially, Lios Nudin's heart-shaped form. Like a well of enchantment, Lios Nudin supplied the other 5 realms with magic, the energy flowing outward to Ionandar, Turguria, Saborian, Oromaira, and Brandokai. Lotionen patted his indignant stallion on the neck and laughed.
"There'll be plenty of time for galloping on the way home,"
he assured him, keeping an attentive eye on the crowds. The walls of Perista offered shelter and protection to 40,000 men. Grassy plains extended for hundreds of miles in every direction, and the population made a decent living from livestock and crops. Farming was profitable in these parts. Perista's produce was considered to be almost as good as that of Tabain, the northwestern kingdom nicknamed the breadbasket because of its fertile fields. Lotionen steered his horse through the bustling streets, dodging carts and carriages, and taking care not to trample pedestrians underfoot. He was already missing the tranquility of his vault. At length, he reached the gates of the palace, closed to ordinary mortals, except by permission of the council.
An invisible trap ensnared foolhardy individuals who tried to slip over the walls. Glued to the masonry like insects on flypaper, they were left to die of hunger and thirst, their magic bonds loosening only when nothing remained but bare bones. In matters of security, the council was unbending. The palace belonged exclusively to the Magi and their staff. Lotionen recited the incantation. The doors swung open as if propelled by an invisible hand, and the Magus rode on. On reaching a sweeping staircase of buff-colored marble, he reined in Furo and slid from the saddle. His path took him up wide steps and through sunlit arcades on paving of elaborate mosaic. White pillars channeled the light from a vaulted glass roof to shine on the colored tiles and show off the intricate designs. The walkway led all the way to the conference chamber, where his presence was awaited. He gave the password, and the doors flew back. The others were there already, seated at the circular table of malachite. Nudine the knowledge-lusty, Turgur the fair-faced, Sabora the softly spoken, Myra the life-preserver, and Andokai the tempestuous. With Lotionen, they formed the Council of Six and disposed of almost limitless power. Each used their magic to pursue a goal of their choosing. Had the Magi seen fit, they could easily have toppled the seven human kingdoms of Girdlegard and annexed their land, but they were intent on perfecting their wizardry, not acquiring worldly might. Lotionen spoke first to Sabora, then greeted the others in turn, before taking his place between her and Turgur. His arrival was acknowledged with brief, stately nods. Sabora clasped his hand and gave it a gentle squeeze.
"I'm glad you're here," she said, smiling warmly.
Her high-buttoned dress of yellow velvet, a straight and somewhat stern affair, reached to the floor. Her short hair looked more silvery than at their last meeting, but her grey-brown eyes were as lively as ever. She sought his gaze.
Andokai was beside herself with impatience.
She lowered her voice to a whisper, so only he could hear.
"So was I, but for entirely selfish reasons."
Lotionen returned her smile. Sabora made him feel like an amorous young man. Their affection was mutual.
"We know why you didn't respond to our summons," Andokai told him.
Her harsh tone made it sound like a reproach. She was attractive in an austere sort of way, and her physique was uncommonly muscular for a Maga, lending credence to the rumor that she could fight as well as any warrior. She wore her hair in a severe blonde plait, and her blue eyes seemed to search for a quarrel.
"Fredegard and Vrabor are dead," Myra explained.
She was taller and slimmer than Andokai, with red hair that fell about her pale white shoulders. Her simple dress of light green cloth was the perfect complement to her eyes, and showed off the gold trinkets hanging from her neck and ears.
"The news arrived just before you did."
She looked over at Nudine.
"It seems to us that the evidence points to the Alfar. We think the Perished Land sent them to thwart our meeting."
Lotionen frowned.
"The Alfar are the Perished Land's deadliest servants, but they've never been known to venture so far south. Nudine tells me that our girdle is failing."
He paused.
"Enemy reinforcements are streaming into Girdlegard in greater numbers than before. Unless we seal the Northern Pass, we'll be meeting in Porista on a regular basis to renew our magic shield."
He drummed his finger vigorously on the table.
"Enough is enough. The Perished Land must be destroyed."
"Oh, absolutely,"
Turgur said scornfully. The famously fair-faced Magus had perfectly symmetrical features, a meticulously shaven chin, a thin moustache, and flowing black locks. Women of all ages swooned at the sight of him, for which he was hated and admired by others of his sex. He was far and away the most handsome man in Girdlegard.
"Why didn't we think of it before? What a fabulous plan, Lotionen."
"This is no time for sarcasm,"
Nudine rebuked him in a hoarse, rasping voice. There was a brief silence as the Magi reflected on their past attempts to defeat their invisible enemy.
"Our magic has done nothing to prevent the Perished Land from casting its shadow over Gauragar, Tabayin, Alandur, and the fallen kingdoms of Lesentiel and the Golden Plains,"
Lotionen said at last.
And it's not for want of trying. We've used enough energy to topple mountains and drain oceans, added Andokai, who knew all about destruction. Samusin, the god of winds, was her deity, and she focused her magic on controlling even the slightest movement of air. Her mood was as changeable as the weather, and her quick temper caused many a storm.
It wasn't enough, though, said Tagur. The perished land has dug its claws into our soil like a great dark beast and won't be shifted.
No, Andokai contradicted him. It's lurking and ready to pounce. If we do nothing, it will attack. Lotionen cleared his throat.
I've been thinking. We know from experience that our combined power is enough to keep the threat in check. If we summon our apprentices to Porista and add their magic to the ritual, we may be able to defeat it.
He looked expectantly at the others. This was no idle suggestion. They each had 30 or more famuli, all of whom could practice magic to some degree.
If we were to harness the magic of 180 wizards, our strength would surely prevail.
Failing that, we'll know for certain that neither might nor magic can defeat our foe,
Nudin commented dryly. The possibility was too dire for Lotionen to contemplate. If nothing was capable of stopping the perished land's incursion, it was only a matter of time before Gerdlegard fell. Every living thing, man, beast, or plant, would be forced to live out its existence as a revenant, dead and yet forever in the service of the northern pestilence. A shiver of fear ran through him.
No, we can't let that happen.
Andokai was the first to find her voice. She seemed anxious as she scanned the faces of the others.
I know some of you don't approve of my allegiance to Samusin, but I stand by my faith. We must act.
I thought your faith would forbid you from driving out the perished land,
Lotionen said in surprise.
Samusin strives for equilibrium. But in the blackest of nights, nothing survives, not even a shadow. If we stand by and do nothing, Gerdlegard will be in thrall to the darkness, she explained. Once the perished land is defeated, the balance will be restored. I'm in favor of the proposal.
The motion was put to the vote and received the council's unanimous support.
Very well, Nudin said hoarsely. But we should renew the existing girdle first. If our defenses crumble before the apprentices get here, we won't be in a position to undertake anything at all. I suggest we break for an hour and have some refreshments before proceeding.
The Magi concurred with the suggestion, and the council dispersed. Nudin beckoned Lotionen to the north-facing window. Seen from close range, the ruler of Leos Nudin looked bloated and swollen. The whites of his eyes were shot with red veins, and his pupils glinted feverishly. It was clear to Lotionen that he was seriously ill. Just then, Nudin was seized by a coughing fit and held a handkerchief to his mouth. With his free hand, he steadied himself on his maple staff. He stuffed the handkerchief hastily away. Lotionen thought he glimpsed blood on the cloth.
You should ask Sabora to lay hands on you, he said anxiously. You look... to be honest, you don't look well.
Nudin arranged his swollen features into a smile.
It's nothing, just a nasty cold. It's good for the body to have something to pit itself against.
He gave Lotionen an approving nod.
That was an excellent idea of yours, you know. Even Andokai was convinced of the scheme, so the others are bound to fall into line.
His face went a violent shade of purple as he struggled to suppress another cough.
We Magi have pursued our own private interests for too long, he continued in a strangled voice. I'm not talking about Sabora, of course. She's always been different. But it's good to see that there are some things on which the council is prepared to take a stand. It's a pity it had to come to this first.
Indeed,
Lotionen said uncertainly. For once, Nudin seemed perfectly amenable, and even his condescending tone was gone. If this was the effect of the illness, Andokai and Tagur could do with catching it as well.
Are you sure we shouldn't be calling you Nudin the Solicitors?
Nudin chuckled good-humouredly, and ended up coughing instead. Lotionen caught a clear glimpse of blood on his lips before he hurriedly dabbed it away.
That does it. I'm sending you to Sabora,
the white-bearded Magus said firmly. This time it was an order.
The ritual will be draining, and you look weak enough as it is.
Nudine raised his hands in surrender.
I give in,
he rasped.
I'll go to Sabora, but one last question. Where are my artifacts, old friend?
Lot Ionan had rather hoped that the matter had been forgotten.
I left them in Ionandar,
he admitted.
I'll get my Fumuli to bring them when they come.
Nudine smiled.
Well, at least you know where they are now. Don't worry, there's no rush. The perished land is our primary concern.
It slipped my mind entirely. I meant to go through the cabinet in my study and pack the things together, but after what you told me about the orcs and the girdle...
Nudine gave him a pat on the back.
Don't worry about it.
He swayed slightly.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I think I'll lie down.
He turned and made for the door, his voluminous robes rustling softly and his staff tapping out a steady rhythm against the floor.
Don't forget to see Sabora,
Lot Ionan called after him. Pensively, he gazed out of the window beyond the artful palace gardens and over the roofs of Perista to the horizon, where the green plains fused with the bright blue sky. There was no sign of the perished land from this distance, but he knew it was there, only a few miles from the city. After a while he felt a gentle hand on his shoulder, and a delicate fragrance wafted through the air. It had been a long time since he had smelled that perfume, and his old heart quickened. He placed his right hand over hers.
My favorite Maga,
he said, turning to face Sabora.
My favorite Magus, she replied with a smile.
He was always delighted to see Sabora. They shared the same attitude where aging was concerned. Neither attempted to disguise the passage of time. He found it reassuring that he wasn't the only one with wrinkles, especially when the others looked so young. No one could accuse Lot Ionan of being vain, but the meetings in Perista made him feel ancient. Andokai, with her 150 cycles, looked no older than 30, while Myra could be taken for 50, despite being 6 times that age. Turgur, of course, was always refining his looks, and maintained the appearance of a vigorous man of 40 cycles. Sabora guessed his thoughts.
Oh, Lot Ionan, she commiserated. They're getting older as well, you know.
They embraced.
So, tell me about your work, she said when they finally drew apart.
It was coming along nicely until one of my assistants ruined a vital part of the formula before I had a chance to try it out,
he reported.
Still, it won't be long before I can render the presence of magic in people and objects visible to the eye. It should mean a breakthrough in our understanding of what magic energy really is. But let's hear about you. Can you cure all our illnesses and ailments?
Sabora slipped her arm through his, and they set off leisurely through the arcades.
I've mastered injuries and wounds, and now I'm focusing my efforts on eliminating the plague. I've been quite successful, actually, she confided. The trouble is, there's no shortage of people with new and mysterious diseases. The gods send us new ailments every day.
You'll get there eventually,
he said encouragingly.
Has Nudine been to see you? He looks dreadful.
Sabora shook her head.
I saw him hurry past earlier, but he didn't stop to talk.
A mischievous smile spread across her face.
If it's his waistline that's bothering him, he'd better ask Turgur. He's the one who knows how to remodel his body and face.
He must be nearing his goal, don't you think? He seems to have lost more of his wrinkles since the last time I saw him. Everlasting beauty can't be much farther off.
They stopped in one of the palace's many gardens and sat down. Sabora laid her head on Lot Ionan's shoulder.
It's incredible, isn't it? She said softly. We all pursue such different goals, but for once we're in agreement.
Myra's support was as good as guaranteed. I suppose you've heard that she's opened her forests to the purest animals of Girdlegard. She's determined to save them from the orcs. As the eldest among us, she knows better than anyone what the northern pestilence would do to Girdlegard.
Yes, her realm is a sanctuary. The last of the unicorns have taken refuge in Oromyra. She paused. If everything goes to plan, Gerdlegard will be safer than it has been for 1,100 cycles, and it won't be a moment too soon.
Lot Ionen laid an arm around her shoulders, savoring her presence. Duty and geography made such moments all too rare.
I was pleasantly surprised by Togur, he confessed. He usually seems so self-obsessed. His life revolves around physical perfection, beauty, aesthetics, and yet...
Sabora laughed.
I expect he's worried about his flawless blossoms and flower beds. He's lavished so much time on perfecting his gardens that it would be a pity to see them ruined by the perished land.
She straightened up suddenly. I heard Gareen was here. Wasn't he one of your apprentices?
Gareen? What would Gareen be doing in Perista? He lives in Greenglade.
Togur said something about a meeting he held with Gareen and one of Nudine's apprentices. It was here in Perista the last time we met.
Now that sounds suspicious,
the Magus said jokingly.
Togur the Fair-Faced meets two of his rival's apprentices and steals their secrets. He'd know all about my work.
Much good it would do him. Charmed beauty combined with the power of discerning magical presences and... She hesitated. What does Nudine do?
He hasn't said.
The Magus shrugged.
Judging by the look of him, he doesn't have time for exercise, so it must be demanding.
Now that he thought about it, he was intrigued. At the next opportunity, he would ask Togur what Gareen had wanted in Perista.
Let's forget about the others,
he said tenderly, wrapping his arms around Sabora and hugging her gently.
We don't spend nearly enough time together.
You're right, she said. I'll ask Andokai to swap kingdoms, and then we'll be a little closer.
I'm sure her subjects would welcome the change. The calm after the storm, isn't that what they say?
Still waters run deep, she informed him with a playful sparkle in her grey-brown eyes.
Kingdom of Gauragar, Gerdlegard. Late Spring, 6,234th Solar Cycle. Tungdil's sharp dwarven vision soon adapted to the darkness. The walls around him had been hewn cleanly from the dark flesh of the mountain and polished to a sheen. Smooth surfaces were the hallmark of dwarven masonry. He couldn't imagine a human laborer going to such lengths. The chilling legend of Cloudpiercer had sounded convincing at the time, but he no longer gave it much credence. From the evidence around him, it seemed likely that the mountain had served as a dwelling, not a mine. Tungdil clambered up a short flight of steps and came to an open portcullis. Beyond